Welcome everyone, Rod from Sports Adventure here, and today we continue our fantastic interview series where I interview inspirational people from around the world to share their expert insights on exercise, good nutrition and men's health. I'm very fortunate today to be able to speak with Mike Miller, Deputy Manager of the consulting team for the Cavern Addiction Services Group, an international private addiction treatment provider with inpatient and outpatient centres across the Asia Pacific, the Middle East and Europe. Hi there, Mike. How you doing?
Hi, I'm good, Rod. Thanks. Thanks for having me.
No worries at all. Hey, thank you. We've just talking a little bit. We've tic-tacked a little bit to put this one together. Really appreciate your time and we'll get straight into it.
Yeah, my pleasure. My pleasure.
Fantastic. Mate, what do you think is so good about being a counsellor for people that you treat in the centre?
Well, I guess what's good about it is helping to facilitate change so that people can live a healthier lifestyle. Well, it has to be all inclusive of physical, mental, emotional, you know, spiritual, whatever that means to an individual, but just kind of the holistic approach to the whole person. The people we get tend to be quite unwell. You know, I don't want to characterize them in any way that would stigmatize them, but, you know, other people, they might characterize themselves as damaged or broken. They've really been through very difficult times. And so what we want to do is help them to regain health, including, of course, in recovery, because we do deal with addictions and traumas a lot. So putting people back together, watching them change their lives and change their relationships with family, we can help them to change generations of their family if they get well. So that's probably the most rewarding part of it, for sure.
Mate, that's unbelievable to be able to help people that have been suffering, if you like, some family long-term trauma there and work through those, turn their lives around. What type of people do you guys see coming through the center?
Well, so obviously addiction is sort of the ultimate leveler of the playing field, where it doesn't matter culture, race, gender, sexuality, age, socioeconomic background. It doesn't discriminate, so to speak. Yeah. That being said, as we are a luxury facility, we tend to get a lot of, and we're located in Thailand, so there's a lot of expats, there's a lot of business people, some celebrities, athletes, some royalty. But as far as luxury goes, we provide five-star luxury treatment. But because we're in Thailand, it's actually at a very affordable price compared to something in the West, which would be probably 4 to 8 times the price of what we provide. So generally people from stable or upper socioeconomic standings, but of all ages and cultures and across the spectrum, all kinds of people.
Yeah, certainly. We spoke briefly about your new facility before we got on the call there and some of the features of that facility. Could you talk through some of those again, Mike? It's quite exciting, really.
Yeah, it's very exciting for us, and I'm always very happy to talk about it because it's very exciting. So we went from a facility that was a resort that we had adapted to our needs, but of course, you know, you're always kind of playing catch up as the needs change and as you expand and grow. So what we did is we have made one of the only purpose-built rehab centers in the world. It is 120 beds broken into 4 different treatment villages, 40 beds, 40 beds, 20 beds, 20 beds. The facilities that are there, there's an indoor air-conditioned gym that has all kinds of top and newest machines, you know, from Universal Gym to bikes and treadmills. And also on the side of that, there's a spin studio that we can use for spin classes. There's a lap pool there. I think it's a 20 meter lap pool that's there. And that is all encased in all glass windows overlooking a mountain. It's really quite amazing. And outside of that, there's a little sports, a playing field of some sort. It's like a joint basketball, soccer field with amphitheater style seating around it. That's shared between the 4 villages, that gym facility. And it's of course got showers and all that kind of stuff. Each village individually has holistic departments that include Reiki, yoga, massage spas, EFT, and different sorts of alternative therapies, you know, because we're trying to treat the whole holistic picture, physical, mental, emotional, everything. Every village has a top of the line restaurant, and of course has a therapy department with counselors, therapists, psychologists, with great group rooms and individual counseling. Also on the site, we have a 10-bed hospital with two psychiatrists on and 24-hour medical staff. That hospital we've actually made available to the local community because we're located up in the mountains in northern Chiang Mai. And so as part of our wanting to contribute to the community, we make that hospital available to the community. And we also have kind of green standing or eco-friendly standing where we have our own water processing plant and the water doesn't get wasted. It gets filtered through and brought back up and used to water our own greens, plants, shrubs, trees, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot of thought has been put into having as little of a footprint as we can on the local community and culture and actually contributing rather than affecting it in a negative way, for sure.
Mm. That's an unbelievable facility. And I must congratulate you and your team for putting that together. And I can imagine something like that to support people that are suffering some serious addictions, and those sort of facilities would certainly help progress through their treatment. And as you said, that holistic approach to get them back on track again.
Absolutely. It is one of the things. I mean, there are, not to take away from the other sort of resources that are available, like, you know, government-funded resources that are a little bit more sort of bare bones, if you will. And I myself, I'm a man in recovery from addiction, and I have been for a number of years. I got clean in a government-funded place that definitely didn't have the luxury that we had. And that being said, it also didn't address everything in a holistic sort of manner. They sort of tried to take care of me mentally, emotionally, physically to the best of their ability. But what I had to do was seek ongoing therapy beyond that what the center could provide. What we do is try to address all of that stuff from the get-go, including, you know, all kinds of addictions, obviously, drugs, alcohol, process addictions, so gambling, compulsive sexuality or sex addiction, food-related disorders, and trauma. We have a trauma track where anyone with underlying trauma, PTSD, anything like that, because those are some of the things, like trauma particularly is something that can underpin the addiction. And if it doesn't get dealt with, you might be looking at a relapse down the road. So we kind of try to, well, I'm very proud of our program. I think we do a very complete job of what we're doing and don't kind of neglect any part of the whole person.
Mm, certainly, mate. That sounds unreal. And congratulations to yourself for being able to work through a program of years gone by. And now you're there leading the crew and helping others. That's admirable. Well done, mate.
Thank you very much. Yeah. For my own personal recovery, I'm obviously quite happy about it. My mother sleeps better at night. Yeah. And for being able to help, you know, I just feel that it's kind of, I'm privileged and it's an honor to be able to watch other people, other men. It is a co-ed facility, but watching people just move forward back into health is really very rewarding.
Mm. No, you bet. Mate, you mentioned quite a broad range of addictions there that you're able to work through with and assist people with. Are there any common problems that you see between a lot of your patients or a lot of the people that you treat that you could generalize a little bit?
Sure. The thing about addiction, I mean, if we look at it historically, you know, the way that people sort of approached addiction, I don't even want to say treatment, but identifying addiction was kind of the moral model where you're bad people, you're weak-willed sinners, and you need to be punished. And, you know, you still hear that today, even though in the 1950s it's been identified as being an illness. But, you know, you even hear people today when they say things like junkies and addicts with that negative connotation. Mm-hmm. But we do know that it is an illness. I know a lot of people kind of bristle when they hear that, but there's a lot of brain science behind that. We aren't just saying it's an illness. You know, there's a recognizable and predictable pathology of what happens in someone's brain, particularly the midbrain, and the reward system isn't working right. So what people do is they pathologically seek reward. anything that they can do that kind of reinforces release of dopamine in that part of their brain. So that comes out when we look at it that way as a disease. Someone doesn't have a gambling addiction or a heroin addiction. They just have addiction. And however that's manifesting, they have, you know, some of the things that we hear is that people talk about feeling uncomfortable in their own skin. They aren't confident. Even if the good things are happening in their life, even if they're really achieving things, they feel as though they don't really belong and that they don't have that confidence. They have a lack of sense of meaning and purpose. They get very unique kind of mind crushing kind of boredom, restlessness. And then all of a sudden they get introduced to something that releases all of those neurotransmitters and then they feel okay.
Yeah.
And whether that's their first drink, first drug, first bet, whatever it is, when they do that and they feel okay, they do that again. And it works in the beginning. That's what happens is people say, well, at the beginning, this was really a useful way for me to be able to show up and do things and interact with people and just get rid of the feelings I had that I didn't like. And then after a while, it stops working. And the consequences start showing up, social and environmental sort of consequences, relationship consequences, financial, legal, health problems. And it doesn't really matter what the face of their addiction is, whether that's, say, cocaine or you know, speaking in Australia, crystal methamphetamine, ice, or gambling, like the pokies. It doesn't matter which one of those are. The consequences are still the same of health problems, relationship problems, feeling a lot of shame, and things start to spiral out of control until at some point, whether it's internalized pressure from the individual, like I really need to get this under control, or externalized pressure, whether that's family, work, legal system saying you need to get this under control. However they get to treatment, the characteristics of the disease are the same no matter what the substance or process is, and it's the same consequences. Some people, it's just happens faster than others. They seem to step off a cliff, whereas others seem to like gradually come down. Like some alcoholics could drink for 25 years, somehow managing to keep it together. Whereas some alcoholics, the consequences come fast and hard. So there's genetic sort of implications in that and environmental and social implications. But most commonalities are the behaviors that go with the compulsive seeking of reward and the emotional and spiritual sort of like hopelessness, helplessness, sometimes suicidality, isolation, that kind of stuff. I could talk forever. I'm rambling.
What you're saying is fantastic, and being able to break it down into a fairly succinct little description, like, I really appreciate that, mate. I think a lot of my listeners would certainly open their eyes to what some of these people are actually going through on a daily basis. And as you said, the implications are far-reaching and have a massive impact on their whole world.
Absolutely,
yeah.
We know that the people around the addict tend to be as negatively impacted as the addict, because the way that those systems work, particularly family systems, the families, in trying to protect the addict from their own consequences, so bailing them out, giving them money, keeping secrets so that, you know, lying to work, oh, he's sick today, whatever those things are, the addict doesn't experience the consequences, but the family members do. They're the ones paying the money. They're the ones having sleepless nights, and they get the consequences, and they don't even get the so-called benefits of being able to get high and forget about it. So yeah, it does have far-reaching implications for you know, and then you go into social implications, the healthcare costs, the policing costs, like there's just so much.
Yeah, mate, that's massive.
Yeah, I don't think that it gets the resources that it needs as far as, because of that moral model, like I don't want my tax dollars going to pay for some junkie to go to treatment, that kind of stuff. Well, your tax dollars are going to a very sick person, going to jail, going to the emergency room, whatever it might be. So one way or another, we all end up paying for it. So it's better to kind of, you know, since I got clean, I haven't cost taxpayers anything. And what I've done is just contributed vast sums of tax dollars. So the payoff is good. It's just getting past that sort of stigmatization of these are bad people who make bad choices, and it's their choices that have them where they are. Granted, what happens with addiction is it comes part and parcel with incredibly unacceptable behaviors, bad decisions. So that's where people don't buy into the disease stuff and start kind of stigmatizing, because it's a really easy target.
Yeah.
But if you spend time talking to addicts, they know that they're behaving in those terrible ways and they just can't stop themselves until they get a chance to break the cycle.
Mate, that's incredible. You mentioned you have a number of different people coming to your centers. How long does it take to, and this is quite a broad question, but for people to be able to start to respond to the processes that you work through with them and have real positive change to their lives?
It's very individualistic. I quite often tell clients or patients, if you bring the willingness, we'll give you the rest.
Yeah.
So if someone comes in with some sort of external pressure to come in, treatment can be very effective as long as they decide they want to do the work. If someone else is self-motivated at the beginning, then that's what they are. They're self-motivated. And some of the benefits happen immediately. They get connection to other people that they can identify with who are going through the same thing as them, had the same struggles, the same shameful behaviors, same family dynamics, that kind of stuff. And then they, as soon as they come in and we start that holistic approach, every person will be getting out of bed in the morning, having a structured day, doing group therapy, doing group exercise, doing more therapy. They'll have massages scheduled. They'll have different holistic services scheduled, and we have a whole range of them. They'll have meals at three meals, healthy meals at specific times every day. So, you know, it really gives their day a structure, which they aren't used to having. They have a curfew. They sleep. So the holistic end of it, just taking care of them, a lot of the physical stuff happens just by implementing structure, and that happens on day one. If someone is in a detox period, their benefits are also happening on day one, but sometimes aren't felt the same because we're just stabilizing them medically first. But that's a big step for someone who needs that. There are people who come and, you know, are treatment resistant, if we can say that. And I think that, you know, we try to help them to see the benefits of changing for the positive. But, you know, there's some what we would call compensatory behaviors. So, you know, sometimes that comes in the form of rebellion. And if that comes, you know, we can be perceived as authority figures and then rebel against us. Or it might come in the form of compliance, where they act like they're doing really well, but they're not. You know, it's kind of like a surfacey thing. Each case is very individualistic. If someone shows up and wants to get well, they will see results very, very quickly. With other people, it might take a bit longer. What we do know is that when addiction was identified as an illness in the 1950s, insurance companies then had to pay for treatment. And what insurance companies did was said, okay, fine, I guess we'll pay for treatment. We'll pay for 4 weeks of treatment. And lo and behold, the 28-day treatment model became the norm. That's a very arbitrary number that, you know, came about because of insurance companies. It has nothing to do with an effective length of time for treatment. We, of course, offer people to come in for 28 days, but we know, and the statistics prove out, that addiction treatment is dose-specific. The longer the treatment, the better the outcome. We can get into, as our program goes, we go kind of deeper through the levels of therapy. So the initial part is identifying the addiction, really kind of getting an idea of the scope and breadth of it to break through any denial that someone might have about how it's manageable or it's not hurting anyone and it's not that bad. Then the second phase of it, sort of, we get into like deeper things where we look at like their boundary issues and different sort of coping mechanisms that they have of denial. And then in the third stages, we get into things like childhood environments and dynamics, and we get into toxic shame and how they deal with fear and anger and the kind of masks and personas that they wear to stop them from being authentic people. So we kind of go deeper and deeper through it. So the longer someone stays, the more sort of intense and impactful, I guess, the treatment could be, the less sort of superficial. Because if someone comes in for 28 days, it's essentially kind of like a triage. Mm. You know, we bandage them up and send them back out. But what we want to do is we want to get them in and heal them, and that takes a longer period of time. Does that mean someone cannot be successful in 28 days? Well, it doesn't, but we're going to provide people with clinical recommendations post-treatment. It all comes down to, I guess if we used an analogy of something like cancer, if you had, and heaven forbid, you have cancer, you go and you do an acute inpatient, which would be the hospital, you get some surgery, and then after the surgery, the doctor says to you, okay, Rod, here's what we need. You got to come back 3 times a week for 2 hours and do some pretty aggressive chemotherapy, and we're going to give you a regime of pharmacological, so medicine, and then you're going to need to change your diet and exercise and live a healthier lifestyle. And if you said to that doctor, I don't know, doc, I'm pretty busy. Maybe I could come in instead of 3 times a week for 2 hours. Maybe I could come every second Wednesday for 1 hour, and I'll take some of this medicine, but not all of it because it doesn't taste very good. And, that exercise, like I'll try, but I don't think I can do it. Your prognosis is going to be very poor. Addiction is the same way. If you want, it's a chronic illness, so it's not going anywhere. This isn't a phase that anyone's going through. They're not hanging out with a bad crowd. I mean, well, they might be, but that's not what's causing the addiction. So what it needs is to keep the symptoms at bay, is it needs some form of treatment on a daily basis. Post-inpatient treatment, you need after or continuing care treatment. We do offer all kinds of that stuff. That's where our outpatient clinics around the world come in. We have online services that we provide, both one-on-one counseling, group therapy online. We have offer 1 week sort of refresher where someone, if they stay sober, they can come back. They can pick a week at, say 3 months down the road, 6 months down the road. I'll come back for that week and I'll do that. They can come back for family sessions. We try to really keep the treatment going, ongoing, because we know when you stop treating the symptoms, they come back.
Mm-hmm. Mate, that's unreal. That your description and what you guys are doing, it's sensational. Absolutely sensational.
Thank you very much. We are very excited. I've worked in rehabs in Canada. I've worked in inpatient, outpatient with addictions doctors. And I really, truly believe that our program will stand up to anything around the world. And our facilities will be head and shoulders above anything around the world. Mm. So we're quite proud of what we do and really just grateful to be able to do it.
Yeah, you bet. Well done, mate. You mentioned a couple of different reasons why someone would come to you, if it's they've made the decision on their own, family pressure, legal direction, something like that. At what point is that person at in their addiction as far as a tipping point, if you like to say, okay, it's the 11th hour type thing? But yeah. Do they say, okay, I need to start moving on this. This is going in a really bad place.
Well, it really depends. I mean, the thing about denial as a psychological mechanism that stops us from being able to see the truth of our situation is that it is incredibly resilient. Denial can be very resilient. So in face of all this evidence that, life is terrible and you're in a really bad spot, some people continue going. And I had a friend who was told if he injects drugs into an artery in his leg one more time, they're going to cut his leg off. And he got his leg cut off because he just couldn't stop it. He did get clean after that. And that's when I met him. I didn't know him when he was using, but that's the level that it gets to for some people of they get hopeless and helpless. But with other people, there's this kind of myth that says you have to let people hit a rock bottom. And I disagree with that. And my colleagues disagree with that. And we think that the externalized pressures can bring the bottom up to people. So one of the things that happens is we think we're loving our loved ones who are addicts. And so we try to protect them from their consequences. Say it's a mother of a 24-year-old boy or something like that. Well, I can't let him live on the street. I have to pay his rent. I have to buy him food. Well, at that point, he doesn't suffer any consequences and all of his money goes to drugs or gambling or whatever it is. If mom stopped doing that stuff, very quickly, he would realize what it's like to have the consequences of being an addict. Now, asking a mother to do that kind of goes against everything that she intuitively knows to be motherly. The unconditional love, do everything you can for your kid. So, when we are encouraging family members to kind of bring the bottom up, help them to have their consequences so that they see it as like, wow, I need to do something about this. It's difficult for them, but we stand by it. And my personal experience is I started drinking at 12 years old and using drugs of various types, marijuana at 14, hallucinogens at 15, cocaine at 16, heroin at 19. I got clean when I was 32. And what had happened is my mother had seen me going through this cycle over and over again. And what she kept doing was bailing me out, literally bailing me out of jail, bailing me out of financial jams, buying me food, buying me, you know, just trying to like kind of soften the blow for me. And while she was doing that, I didn't have much motivation to change because everything was taken care of and I could just get high. Then one day she said, I'm done. If you don't get some help, I'm not supporting you at all anymore. Within 4 days, I was in a rehab and I haven't used again. She took away my safety net, and that was the catalyst for me realizing like I have to stand on my own 2 feet, like sink or swim time. And I chose to swim, I guess. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean that if someone tries to bring the bottom up and says to their loved one, you know, that's it, I'm done, I'm not going to support you anymore, as a way to help them make it as a catalyst to move forward and to help the family not have to be held hostage to the addictive process, that addict might not choose to get help. And unfortunately, we know that this is chronic, we know it's progressive, and any illness that's progressive, you know, tends to be fatal at the end of the progression, if it progresses that far. So it's difficult for family members to get their head around that. And, you know, I have no illusions. I know that when my mother told me that, it was hands down the hardest thing she's ever done, took the most courage to do it. But what happened was she got a little bit of education about addiction from someone who knew. And they said to her, you know that you think you're loving him, but you're killing him. Every dollar you give him is another dollar he can use. You're loving him to death. And at that point, she said, okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. And it was incredibly difficult for her. She dealt with all the kind of stuff that families deal with, the guilt and like, where did I go wrong? What did I do? Did I make this happen? The truth of the matter is she didn't make it happen. It just, you know, this is like an imbalance in my brain, for lack of a better word. And when she kind of drew the line under it and said no more, what she did was she made me get well. She made me take the steps to go get well. And that, you know, I could never be more grateful for her. And part of our program that we offer is a family program to family members of our patients or our clients. And it's free of charge, intensive 3-day program. I just came back from running the first day of it today with one of my colleagues. And when I get to work with family members, part of me thinks that it's kind of balancing the scale for all the crap that I put my mother through, because she loves me the most and suffered the most, right? So,
mate, that's an incredible story. And as you said, for a mother to be able to get to that point, to do that, to make that call, would be the hardest thing in the world for a mother to do. And also for you to be able to draw on your experience and help all those family groups that are coming through your facility, that's incredible. Absolutely incredible, mate.
Thank you. Yeah, it's and I look at it as like, it's just an honor to kind of be part of it. And, you know, it would be a shame to take all of that mess and not be able to do something good with it and turn it around.
Yeah, no, congratulations, mate. Without mentioning names, obviously for confidentiality, you'd have a number of incredible examples of people that have been through your facility and come out the other side back to their real self. Could you talk through a couple of those?
Sure. I mean, I can talk about I think it was the second client that I had at the cabin who, an Australian ICE using gambler, which soon after I dealt with this client and started to have some success, that became my kind of niche market. I think I became at one point Australia's preeminent treatment provider, because all of my clients seemed to be kind of laddie, tattooed, ICE using, gambling kind of guys. But this guy, you know, he's from a prominent family, good business family, and he just found himself, you know, kind of going down that road. And he was deep down that road. He was very, very hurt, which tended to come out as anger. And he was a big man. And, you know, he got quite angry with me at times when I would challenge him and confront his addiction. You know, I've been at the cabin for a little over 4 years. He just sent me a message, a letter that said he's 4 years clean. In that time, he has returned to the family business. gotten married, had a child, and the note that he sent me in the letter is something that we used to work on all the time around like living by his values and stuff. And it said, today I live as a man of honor. And, you know, his life flipped 180. And, you know, I'm incredibly proud of him and very grateful for him. And he's really turned out to be a lovely guy, which is probably not the assessment most people would have given of him and his addiction.
Yeah.
Because our behaviors can be very poor. So he's one of my early successes, or not mine, it's his success. I just kind of walked. I'm not taking responsibility for that. I got to walk with him and kind of be honored to go on that journey with him. But he's a success story. And then, you know, we've had so many that are like that. People that, young males that we have, that there's kind of a term that we call, it's called failure to launch. So they're 20s, early 30s, never really had to learn any sort of life skills, or they might come from affluent families, so they get given jobs and given all kinds of things. They don't have to earn it. So they really are in some ways handicapped for living life, and they're very bored and they're not rewarded. So what they do is they drink and use drugs and gamble and do all of that. And we have had a number of them end up being, you know, returning to workforces and becoming educated, helping other people. I can think of one in particular who's gone, well, actually, that's not true. I can think of two in particular that have gone on to work in the field of addictions, helping other people based on their experiences. And there's just so many. And it's difficult because, like you say, because of the confidentiality, I can't speak too detailed about any particular case, but definitely there are lots of men and women that we've seen come address their traumas, go through incredibly painful therapeutic experiences where they're digging up all kinds of history of trauma and abuse, and, you know, facing it head on with a therapeutic and clinical team that supports them in it. Just the amount of courage that they show is amazing. And to watch them come out and flourish at the other end and be there for their families and hold up their end in their family relationships. You know, I get emails from family members, from clients years ago that, you know, are just, we're just so happy, we're so proud of him or her. And there's just so many, it's kind of hard to keep track of them all, the successes.
Sure. That is absolutely overwhelming. And I think in summary, you could say that an addiction, there's not one stereotype, anyone that this impacts on. It's probably like mental health in some cases. It can affect anyone at any age, in any point in their life. And, mate, you guys are doing some fantastic things. They're some great stories there, mate.
Oh, well, thank you very much. And, yeah, you're absolutely right. We have had clients in their teens, and we have had clients in their 70s. We have had, you know, people who are unemployed and when they walk in unemployable, to incredibly successful people in all walks of life, and addiction just doesn't care. And the thing I think about addiction, you know, all these places, including us, have different sort of statistics about success rates and, like, you know, if you go through this much treatment, what the success rates are, what the stats are, blah, blah, blah. There's only one statistic that really is meaningful to me, and that is that 100% of people can get well from this. It's just, you know, there's a proven method to getting well, and it's just about getting people to buy into that, I guess, for lack of a better word, because of the psychological aspects of the illness, the denial. You know, people push away help sometimes, and that's difficult to see. You know, and I think the stigma doesn't help, but what I do know is that if people want to get well, we absolutely help people get well all the time. And there's a ton of evidence of that, and nobody has to think that it's a hopeless situation. There's lots of help out there, and we're just one version of it. I think we do a hell of a job. I might be biased. I don't know.
Perhaps a little bit, but I think you have a right to be biased. From what you're telling me here today, this is blowing my mind. It's unreal. Unreal, Mike. Mate, if you had a secret about addiction, what would that be?
I guess the secret about it is that there's so many little, like, kind of gems of wisdom that I wish I could impart to people. These are not bad people trying to get good. These are sick people trying to get well. This is an illness. No matter what people say about it, there's so much evidence of what happens in the brain. This is not a cop-out by saying it's a disease or an illness. It's a very predictable pathology in the reward center of the brain. And it really responds really, really well to treatment. And there's a proven method for getting well. There's a ton of hope. And I guess, you know, these are our brothers, sisters, mothers, fathers, children, cousins that, you know, I wish we could be more empathetic to not stigmatizing and demonizing people because of the, you know, terrible behaviors that seem to come hand in hand with it. If we could look past and separate the people from the behavior and think, this person's unwell, how can we help them get well? That's what I wish people would kind of be able to understand is that these aren't throwaway people. These aren't terrible people. These aren't bad people. This could be you. This could be anybody.
Yeah.
And, you know, I wish that people would just kind of get on board with something that we've known since the 50s. Mm. This is an illness.
Mm. Yeah, certainly. What would you suggest if someone has a friend or a family member that they suspect or they know is suffering from addiction? What's something that they could do to perhaps, as you've touched on a few points there, but to help them in the right direction, if I can put it that way?
Sure, absolutely. So what I would suggest is education and resourcing themselves. So if I look at Australia, for example, I know that we have an outpatient office in Sydney. We have one in Melbourne. If people were to contact them and say, what do I do? We could absolutely provide education, resources, supports. How do you help someone get into treatment? How do you intervene and try to help save someone's life? People need to be educated about that, because what tends to happen is we get sucked into the cycle without some kind of professional help, because, you know, we're so emotionally invested in it and we become sort of overwhelmed. We don't have the resources. We don't have the knowledge. We don't know what to do. We think we're helping, but we're not. We're usually, even though we're doing everything that seems intuitive and loving, we're usually helping to further the addiction without meaning to, in an unintentional way. And what I need at that point is someone who can be objective and knowledgeable to help me and support me. So I would suggest, you know, of course, because I believe in what we do, I would say contact us. We have numbers and emails. Anyone that has any sort of need to get support or education could go onto our cabin website. I think it's probably thecabin.com, maybe, or cabinchiangmai.com, one or the other. And, you know, there's links on there that would help you to be able to contact somebody. And it's just basically the addict can't get well by themselves and the family can't get them well by themselves. That tends to be the truth. As much as the addict needs supports, the family and friends also need supports, because without the proper education, we usually, with the best of intentions, you know, don't do the right stuff.
Yeah. I think you're spot on. And the contact details for the cabin I'll include at the end of this post. And, mate, I might wrap it up there. I'm just absolutely blown away what you guys are doing and what you've shared with us tonight. And I really appreciate your time. I think I could keep talking to you about this for hours, but as I said, it's the end of the day there for you. You've had a huge day. Again, thank you for your time tonight, Mike, and all the best with what you're doing. Mate, you're an absolute champion.
Thanks, Rod. I appreciate it. And consider yourself invited to come and see the new state-of-the-art facility anytime. You know, not as a client.
Mate, I would love to. I would absolutely love to. And one day I'm going to take you up on that, Mike. So thank you very much for the invitation.
My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks for the time and for the interview. I appreciate it. And we as an organization appreciate it.
Terrific. Not a problem at all. Thanks again, Mike.
No problem. Take care, Rod.
To hear more great interviews from experts around the world on good nutrition, exercise and men's health, head over to www.sportsadventure.com.au or jump onto iTunes or Stitcher, subscribe to the podcast and leave a review. Thanks for tuning into the show.